recharge, just because of having more electrons, it would be more negative. Anything like that. So, in the atom of the element, either gains or loses the electrons, they refer to the ionization of an atom. So, this will result in increase or decrease in the electron presence in the atom element. If the number of electrons reduces, then the element will have a positive charge, but if the number of electrons increases, the element becomes negatively charged. But anyhow, however we say it, the atom is ionized, but not necessarily it is a plasma. So what is the plasma? It's an interesting factor because not really the fourth state of the matter is pretty much recognized everywhere universally, but we have a three states of matter, which is solid, liquid, and gas, and the fourth one would be the plasma, because it is not a gas, although it does have a properties of gas. So if you have a very simply ionized gas, right, if you have an ionized gas, provides for free electrons for atoms or molecules and electrons of species and ions together, right? Then if they are able to coexist, then we have plasma. And the funny thing about this is that as far as we knew, the plasmas are the most common state of the matter in the universe. And they're in common here on the Earth. A plasma is a gas that has been ionized to the point of some of the electrons break free, but travel with their nucleus. So that's the plasma. What do we use it? Torches. Torches would be one of the examples of the plasma. We have a sun that rips electrons of the hydrogen and helium, creating a plasma. And to HGN.
Okay. Is it possible to have a plasma that is not ionized, or is it possible to have ionized material that's not a plasma? Ionized material, as I see it, means that some of the electrons have been separated from some of the atoms. The atoms that are lacking electrons are positive. The electrons that are free are now negative. So you've got these two charged particles that happen to be local probes nearby, local objects with polarity on them, voltage on them. The electrons will get sucked into the positive probe, and the nucleuses will be sucked over toward the negative probe. I'm having a little trouble seeing how, when you have ionized material, how you could get an imbalance, because if you're starting off with a finite amount of material, and if some of those electrons are leaving their atoms, then the exact number of electrons that are leaving tells you exactly how much negative charge you've got of those free floating particles, and it tells you exactly how much charge you're going to have for the remaining atoms that are lacking electrons. So it seems like the whole plasma cloud, or the whole ionized cloud as a whole, is going to be balanced. I'm having trouble seeing how you can create an imbalance, and therefore, is there really a difference between an ionized material and a plasma material? You see where I'm going here? It's not quite clear to me here, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
There's some examples with the bananas, because atoms and molecules are actually neutral. So, and the number of positively charged electrons is exactly equal to the number of positively charged protons. Much as the normal matter, we find around us. But when the energy sources are available, atoms or molecules can gain or lose electrons and acquire the net electrical charge. And this process not necessarily is ionization, because we have a flow of the electrons because of the electric current. Now what is happening is that atom is losing the loosely bonded electrons from the outer shell. Usually there would be, if we have a K, L, M, N, O, there would be O, O, N. Right, depends what atom we're talking about. The flow of electrons, you cannot assign to ions or the ionization stage, therefore assign it automatically to plasma. There must be certain distinctions between plasma and ion. Do you agree with that so far?
I'm not sure. I do know that, for instance, a neon bulb, a neon lamp, or a neon tube that's used for a display in the window of a store, it has a lower pressure of neon gas in there, simply because when the gas is at a lower pressure, the mean free path of free electrons is longer, therefore the breakdown voltage is smaller. You would have an extremely high breakdown voltage of neon if it wasn't a partial pressure inside of that neon lamp. But the neon inside of that lamp starts off as a neutral gaseous material until you put the high... voltage, which creates the breakdown, which creates the plasma, which creates the light emission of the neon. So once that breakdown takes place, because you put a high enough voltage for that particular gas pressure, then as I see it, what you've got is a neutral material that became a plasma, and it became an ionized material. And in the case of the neon inside of a lamp, when you go from neutral state without the voltage applied, and then you have a conducting state when you apply the voltage and you're getting the light output, that material that's inside of that lamp, from my point of view now, it is both a plasma and it's an ionized material. In that particular example, is that wrong now, Wes? In 2XJN, K2RIW. Okay, I'm not... 3J, KQRIW.
Has this crazy inverse relationship. The higher the pressure,
the higher the voltage it takes to break it down. And neon is one of those. And I guess the main reason why a neon tube runs at partial pressure. But that neon, once you ionize it to give off the light, yes, it's ionized, and yes, I think it's a plasma. So I'm not sure there's a distinct difference between the two. I guess if we Google those two words and look in a dictionary, and maybe a chemical dictionary or a physics dictionary, maybe it will differentiate between the two. See if you've got any words to add to this one, John. I'm a little bit confused, as you can tell. KC2, WGB, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Well, Dick, it brings a question to mind. Okay, if we take any element and we heat it sufficiently, we can gasify it. All right. Is that a plasma in itself, or do we have to apply a voltage to call it a plasma? Or, if we heat it enough, does it develop any electrical energy and become a plasma without the applied voltage? What do you think on that?
Yeah, I'm relatively sure that when I heat up a chunk of steel, it starts glowing dull red, eventually yellow and white, as I heat it more and more. It's now giving off light. In fact, everything above absolute zero is emitting electromagnetic energy. The background radiation of space, the leftover from the Big Bang, 2.73 degrees Kelvin. Let's call it 3 degrees Kelvin. You can measure, that's what Penzias and Wilson did. Arlo Penzias and I forget Wilson's first name, at Bell Laboratories, roughly 1968, using that great big Hoghorn antenna at Homedale, New Jersey. They measured the amount of radio noise coming from space, because space has cooled off to the degree of 3 degrees Kelvin. So everything above absolute zero is emitting electromagnetic energy. And the amount of electromagnetic energy it emits total is a function of T to the fourth, temperature to the fourth power. So as you heat something up, it emits electromagnetic energy. It starts off at infrared. As you heat it more and more, the peak of the radiation moves to shorter and shorter wavelengths, higher and higher frequencies. And eventually your and my eye sees it. Even if I'm heating that chunk of steel, let me drop. I'm heating that chunk of steel with my blowtorch, and I haven't gotten it bright enough yet that where my eye can see it as a dull red. Way before that temperature, if I look at it with a thermal imaging camera, I will see the fact that that steel is hot.
Connecting to KD2AKX.
Okay, it looks like somebody, Mr. AKX, is going to join us. So, as I see it,
it's not yet
a plasma. It's just emitting at a wavelength that my eye can see. I can take my hand and put it against the wall, and then remove my hand. And 30 seconds later, you come along with a thermal imaging camera. Your thermal imaging camera will show the handprint on that wall, because a portion of the wall is warmer from where my hand touched it, and therefore it's emitting more energy. Everything above absolute zero is emitting some electromagnetic energy. Those molecules are shaking in space, and that shake creates some emission.
That's not yet a plasma.
As I see it, just heating up the wall a little bit with my hand is certainly not disassociating a positive and negative ion and making a plasma. It takes much higher temperatures and much higher voltages to do that, in my opinion. Let's see if anyone else who has joined this machine right now wants to give us their opinion. Go right ahead with your call letters. KQRIW in the TechNet. Listen. I heard somebody signing into the node, and therefore I thought they were going to join us with some further opinion. So the fact that you see it, that means the wavelength of emission is short enough or the frequency is high enough that my eye now responds. That's not a plasma. That chunk of steel that's hot enough to glow, I don't think that's a plasma. I haven't disassociated those positive and negatively charged particles. But in the case of a gas that I heat to a high enough temperature
and I, particularly if I pass a voltage through that gas and I get a breakdown, I think almost every single spark is a plasma. It is ionized material, obvious by the fact that current is flowing through that spark. The voltage I'm applying is creating current to flow. And so, how do we differentiate? Ain't clear. Over to you, John, for any further comments. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Dick, I heard also at least two people that were putting out their call sign there. Don't know if they're out there. As soon as that break, you can come on. Yeah, I see it the same way, Dick. So we can heat a gas to a very high temperature, and then we can excite it, and it will be conductive. Okay, so the plasma is conductive. Now, I don't know what temperature we have steel to cause it to gasify, but I imagine that can be done with, as with any element. But I agree. I think they work together. I don't think you can have one without the other when you're talking about plasma. Sure, you can have a gas, but it's not going to conduct electricity until you excite it by increasing that temperature. I think you're on the right track, in my opinion.
Yeah, I've got a guess as to what's going on here. Just heating a gas doesn't necessarily make it a plasma. Just like heating a chunk of steel, it's not yet a plasma. However, if I heat the gas enough, I think it does become a plasma. Obvious by the fact that when you re-enter a spacecraft, 17,500 miles an hour, it hits the atmosphere, and you get that radio blackout. That is a plasma. And so you're impacting those air molecules with a very high velocity spacecraft, and because the temperature is so high, that's a fancy way of saying the air molecules have a whole lot of kinetic energy. That's a fancy way of saying they've got a very high speed. You could normally say velocity, but you know what I mean. The individual air molecules are moving so fast that they now, for the first time, can crash into each other, create a chain reaction, and break up the molecule into separate electrons and protons, separate electrons and the rest of the nucleus. Ordinarily, air molecules bounce off each other thoroughly losslessly, thoroughly perfect bounce. Those air molecules hitting the walls of the container, hitting the wall of your room, hitting each other because of the strong electrostatic charge of that cloud of electrons around each air molecule, they never come very close. Until the velocity of the air molecules is high enough, now they can hit each other and they can create ionization. So with very high temperatures, I think it's happening. I am guessing a blowtorch meets that criteria. You and I could prove that by putting two probes inside the flame of a blowtorch and putting a voltage between the two. I'm reasonably sure we would sense a current. And once you sense a current, I'm pretty sure you've got a plasma. See where I'm going with that one there, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. And I was just thinking the same thing. What we could do is build what looks something like a Jacob's ladder. Take a butane torch or something like that and put a voltage on those two elements, cause that flame to cross both planes of that wire and see if we get a current. That gas should be plasma at that temperature, I believe. That would be a good proof.
Yeah, I bet you you've got all the material to do that. I bet you you own a Jacob's ladder. I know you own a torch. And ordinarily, a Jacob's ladder has got that spark starting at the bottom and traveling up. And you take a good-sized torch somewhere in the middle of that Jacob's ladder and aim the torch sideways so that the flame is going across both of those wires. I am guessing the spark will jump to that location and stay there during the time the flame is there. The flame will become the conducting material, and quite possibly you will be extinguishing any other spark that was on your Jacob's ladder, because now the dominant path for the voltage to flow through will be through your flame, and therefore the rest of the Jacob's ladder doesn't get a chance to build up a high enough voltage to make a spark anywhere else. That's what I think you're going to experience, And I bet you've got all the hardware in your laboratory to do that experiment, John. I think we're mentally constructing an experiment here. KC2WGB, about to get pretty hot in that laboratory. K2RW, you got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, in fact, I was just formatting some type of experiment. I may do it with a Wimhurst machine. Place the Wimhurst machine connected to the Jacobs ladder and bring it up to where it's almost at breakdown, and then run a flame across it and see if it produces a breakdown. That would be interesting.
The only thing wrong with that one, John, is that your and my Wimhurst machine, even though we didn't pay very many dollars for it, has got this nice stainless steel shiny probes to it. And you start putting a blowtorch across that, you're going to tarnish them. It's not going to be as pretty looking. Eventually going to get kind of ugly. Whereas with your Jacob's ladder, which is quite often got a simple piece of inexpensive wire, it could be coat hanger wire or copper wire, which is easy to replace. And so, I guess by the same token, you and I could wrap some copper wire around the probes of the Wimhurst machine. And out where those probes extend, where the wire, the copper wire extends beyond the probes, there you do the experiment. I'm a little bit reluctant to have you aim a torch at that beautiful chunk of stainless steel, nice round bowl at the end of each of those probes. Over to you, John. K2LIW.
KC2WGB. That's exactly what I would do, Dick. I would place the Wimhurst machine direct contact with those two wires, basically just what you said, and then bring it up to a speed where we don't hit an arc, and see if the flame will cause it to discharge. That could be done very interestingly.
You've got it. And whether you bring the probes up to the two wires, or you could take a piece of copper wire, wrap it around the shaft of one of those probes of the Wimhurst machine, so that it becomes a tight spiral, and then make the end of the copper wire extend an inch or two or three beyond the end of the probe. Do that on each probe. Now you've got two extended pieces of copper wire in intimate contact with the probes of the Wimhurst machine. And now the tips of those copper wires, bend them any way you want, bring them close together, bring them to near the point of arc over with voltage, and put a flame across them. I think that's the easiest way of doing it. A little bit similar to what I used to do with my soldering gun. I would wrap a piece of copper wire around the tip of the soldering gun and then file it down to a sharp point, and now I could do micro-miniature work, if you know what I mean. So I wonder if you were able to get that particular picture, John. Over to you, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely. And I like that idea because I could wrap the wire around the probes on the Wimhurst machine and bring it out at right angles to the disk so that the flame and the heat won't be going anywhere near the Wimhurst machine. That should work well.
You've got it, John. Now, we heard, John and I heard a couple of people signing into the node which connects to this particular machine. And if so, if that person was doing so in order to ask us a question or make a comment, please make yourself known right now. So whoever was signing in, go ahead and identify yourself. K2RIW listening. I'm not sure I heard somebody. Did you, John?
No, I did not. I was monitoring both inputs, and I don't hear anything. It's quiet. And it seems like the 8.5 is working.
Okay. 8.5 is working under a normal input. Is that what you're saying, John? Where... In fact, let me try that. All I got to do is grab the right. I got to turn on any controls here. Stand by. No, I don't think the normal input is working, John. Do you think it is? I don't. Over to you, John. K2RIW.
Okay, I was monitoring the output on another receiver, and I thought it was working.
Yeah, everything we say on this machine is coming out of 8.5. But if I go to the normal input for 8.5, it doesn't come out. And I sort of understand why. That's where the interference is coming from. Alrighty. you probably have some other older material of the guys who have sent you emails, John, on the mailbag. Could you choose one of those? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I have a few. One is quite a complicated construct, which I have to describe to you. Let's see what else I have here. I wanted Glenn to try to do that diode thing, but he's not available. I guess he's watching the bowl. I watched the puppy bowl by today. That was cute.
Yeah, by the way, I'm monitoring also the input of the A5 machine, and it's got a lot of noise right now. So I can see why most likely Eric has not enabled that one. And when it comes to Glenn discussing diode, I think you were saying that Glenn was going to give us a further description of a light-emitting diode. Maybe that's what you're talking about. But this elaborate construct, go right ahead and describe it to us, John. K2RIW.
Okay. I have a, let's see. Well, he's in his 30s, and he is a ham. Okay. What he has an oscillator control system he's working on. And what it is, it's three cones, like ice cream cones. They start out at about 4 inches in diameter and taper for about 6 inches to the point. Okay, the apex of the coin. On those cones, he wound about 100 turns of, I think it's number 36 or something around that size on the cones. So he has three of those cones. But we're going to discuss the function of two of them because basically it's the same. You have that construct so far, Dick?
Yes, I think I do. So the cone's about 4 inches in diameter, taper to a sharp point. I'm going to guess like 4 inches higher. And now I think you're saying there is a spiral of wire wound up on that cone. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The height of the cone is about 6 inches. And he does have a wire wrapped the whole length of the cone, no space between it, very tightly wound. And now what he's doing is inserting one cone into another. And what he's asking is the inductive coupling that he's experienced and the capacitance coupling, do they both run in a linear fashion if one Henry increased in the cone in 1 inch and he notices 5 picofarads. If it goes 2 inches, will it be 2 and 10 picofarads? That's basically the question he's asking.
Okay, that's an interesting set of questions. Because each one of those is a coil in air, I'm assuming the cone itself is a
paper.
Okay, paper cone. So it's a non-conductive material, a dielectric material. Therefore, each one of those coils is in air. And when I bring two coils together that are both in air, it is my opinion there's very little change in inductance. In other words, if I had a chunk of ferrite iron that I slipped over or inside of that cone, so that now there's magnetic material for the field of the turns of wire. If current is flowing through those turns of wire, they're making a magnetic field, and if that magnetic field can flow through something that has a mu greater than air, and all ferrite does that, then yes, the inductance will increase. But as you bring those two cones together, there's still each a cone in air. The wire of the other turns of the other cone is no substantial difference in the way the magnetic field flows through it, no real change in inductance. So the mutual coupling between the cones is going to increase substantially as you bring them together. The inductance of either winding is not going to change, but the capacitance will change. As you bring them together, the capacitance increases. Well, let's think about that. If it was two flat plates that I'm bringing together, let me drop.
Hey, Dick.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, on the input, is it getting stronger or weaker?
A little bit weaker, but still plenty of signal on the input, Eric. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know there's plenty of signal, but I'm just wondering, which direction the guy's going, that's all. Because it seems to be coming up and then going down over here.
It's getting reasonably weak here. My antenna is aimed toward Glen Oaks. So with the antenna in that direction, he's getting quite weak. Go ahead.
All right, that gives me a clue. Thank you.
So if I've got two flat plates, and I measure a certain number of picofarad between the two. And by the way, a very handy formula is 0.225 A over T. If I'm using all the dimensions in inches, and I know the area of my two plates and the distance between the two, 0.225 A over T. A is area, T is spacing between the two plates. Plug in the formula for the area of the plates and the distance between the two, and it will predict for you how many picofarad you've got. So if I half the spacing between two flat plates, I double the capacitance. I'm divided by a T number that's half as big, and therefore the result of dividing into the area gets twice as big. So with flat plates, there's a direct relationship between capacitance and spacing. However, these cone-shaped objects have a much more complicated electrostatic field between the two. And the first question a person would ask is if I half the distance between the two cones as I insert one into the other, do I get exactly twice the capacitance? There I'm not sure, but I know the direction it's going to go. The capacitance is going to increase with closer and closer spacing. But I think there's going to be almost no change in inductance of either winding as I bring those two cones together. And that's a very interesting kind of variable conductance transformer. There's always going to be a certain coupling coefficient between, let me just, a certain amount of magnetic field coupling between the first winding and the second winding, call it primary and secondary, if you know what I mean. Bringing them closer together is going to create greater coupling, greater capacitance, but no real change in inductance if you're not bringing any ferrite nearby. Those are a bunch of guesses on my part. I'm trying to give you a little clue as to where the guess is coming from, John. And what do you believe is the major motivation of this particular experiment? KC2WGB. Getting deeper into our mailbag. K2RIW, the tech now.
Okay, I'm only estimating his use for this, but he did state that it was for the control of an oscillator. Okay. Now, I think I may have phrased it wrong. The inductive coupling is increasing as the cone enters the second cone, along with the capacitance. Maybe his question is related to the inductive coupling. Does it increase in a linear fashion, and is the ratio approximately the same for both the capacitance function and the inductive coupling?
Yeah, whenever you bring two coils together, they call it mutual reactance. You could also call it coupling coefficient. Slightly different, but a similar phenomenon. And if I made an oscillator out of that, in other words, the output of my transistor is going to one coil, and the other coil is going to the input of the transistor, therefore I've got a feedback path that makes an oscillator. And so by bringing these cones together, I'm changing the coupling coefficient, I'm changing the amount of feedback, and I'm guessing his major motivation is to try to build an oscillator where the frequency changes as a function of spacing of the two cones. And he probably chose two cones because he would like to have a very large range of frequency by bringing them together. And we've got a problem here as I see it. And that is, in order for an oscillator to give you a nice, stable oscillation, there is a specific amount of feedback magnitude you want to have. In other words, if my transistor has a gain of 10 decibels, and if my feedback path has a loss of 9 decibels, therefore my loss is lower than my gain, therefore I've got a loop gain of plus 1 dB, and if I set things up correctly, I got a beautiful stable oscillator. If I make the coupling coefficient stronger and stronger, I make the amount of insertion loss between output and input go to smaller and smaller numbers, so that now my feedback path has 1 dB of loss, 10 dB of forward gain, I've got 8 dB of feedback ratio positive. Now the feedback being so strong quite often will build up an unstable oscillator. It'll become a blocking oscillator. It'll oscillate in bursts. So by changing the feedback ratio, you end up with a very unstable oscillator. And so moving these cones in and out, I am guessing his motivation was to have a very large range of frequencies of the oscillation. The main thing he's doing is changing the feedback ratio, and therefore I think the oscillator is going to become unstable as he moves the cones very close together. That's a guess on my oscillator experience, John. It may not be the way to get a very wide range tuning of an oscillator. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, that brings up a couple of questions that I have. Well, first of all, he's working with three cones. I have no idea what the third cone would be, or what it's going to be connected to. All right, but I knew we could work with two cones. He might have a good idea for a seismograph here. that might work out, but I can't imagine what he'd be doing with this. Strange. Now, how about if we were to do a planar type of cone on a piece of printed circuit board, if we had something that looked like a Christmas tree, and we made two of them, put one on top of another, and then varied that, one over the other, could we get basically the same effect? And he's not recommending this or asked this, I just thought about it.
When you first said planar network, in other words, I could make a spiral coil that's in a flat plane, I could build a pair of those, and I could bring them closer and further apart. And again, you're going to have the same situation of very large coupling coefficients. Now, when you say Christmas tree to me, side view, is a cone. So I'm not quite sure what Christmas tree means in that case, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
Exactly, Dick. If we were to lay it out sort of where it would look like a Christmas tree, only it would be one continuous foil zigzagging back and forth, it would still have the shape of a planar Christmas tree. And if we laid one over the other, maybe the operation would be very similar?
Yes. See, in the case of an oscillator, what makes it choose a particular frequency is that normally you've got a capacitor across a coil somewhere. That coil plus capacitor follows the formula 1 over 2 pi square root of LC as the resonant frequency. And so you get an oscillator by having a object with gain, usually an amplifier, feedback, and if you make the loop gain greater than unity, you have the ability to make an oscillator. And if one of those feedback networks, whether it be the resonator that's in the output of the amplifier or the resonator that's in the input of the amplifier, either one of those resonators will have a characteristic, a passband characteristic, that's a Gaussian shape curve. Every resonator does that. As you hit the resonant frequency, you get a lot of signal fed through. If you're far away from resonant signal, you get very little response out of that coil. So your feedback path really only has gain at the resonant frequency when you set things up just right. So it is in LC ratio, LC combination, that gives you the resonant frequency, and the feedback path gives you the loop gain. And in the example I gave before, I've got an amplifier with a gain of 10. I've got a feedback path with resonance that at the resonant frequency has a feedback loss of 9 dB. Therefore, I've got 1 dB of excess gain. Therefore, I will oscillate. However, what determines the strength of the oscillation? The frequency is determined by the resonance. The strength is determined by limiting. Let me drop it. That oscillator, because it's got greater than unity gain, is going to build up a signal that will always continuously be increasing in amplitude. Your output transistor is putting out 1 milliwatt now, and it goes to the loop, and then it becomes out 1.1 milliwatt, 1.2 milliwatts. Because the gain is greater than unity, the signal will continuously increase in amplitude until limiting takes place. At some particular strength of DAC signal, the transistor can no longer give you 10 dB of gain. It only gives you 9 dB gain. It's 1 dB in the limiting. That determines the amplitude. Every oscillator has feedback greater than unity when it starts oscillating. When it's in continuous steady state oscillation, the total loop gain is exactly unity, 1.00000 in amplitude, or 0.000 in decibels of gain of the loop. Every oscillator does that. Now you get a little bit of a feeling for what happens when your feedback path is too strong. If I've got too much feedback, too little loss in the feedback path, let me drop. At first you say, gee, that's great, I'm going to build up an amplitude real fast. Yeah. But if I've got 9 dB of excess loop gain, that means the only place where that oscillator will be stable is at that amplitude where it's got 9 dB of limiting. Okay. When it's got 9 dB of limiting, which is a lot of limiting, instead of it creating a beautiful sine wave in the output, it's starting to produce square waves. Okay. The square waves have got a whole lot of harmonics to them. Therefore, periodically, it decides to jump to one of those harmonics because it's still got unity, above unity gain in one of those frequencies. You end up with an unstable oscillator. The feedback path is so strong, it changes the bias, and therefore it can become a super regen-like oscillator, or it can jump around in frequency. So having too much feedback, at first you'd say it's good. Usually it's bad. You want just enough feedback to give you a reliable start of oscillation, but you don't want so darn much feedback that when it goes into limiting in order to achieve unity gain, which it must do, that now it has the ability to find other modes of oscillation. So too much feedback is not good. So by moving two coils closer and further together, one is the output, one is the input, the main thing you're doing is not changing resonant frequency, you're changing feedback ratio, changing loss of the feedback path. Therefore, you're changing loop gain, and you can easily enter unstable regions as far as an oscillator is concerned. There's a lot of science that goes into making a good, clean, sine wave, pure, stable oscillator. And to make an oscillator produce pure sine waves without any clipping, you'd be amazed how difficult that is. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, it's a lot to think about. So if we can't maintain the tickler voltage at the right level, we could get into square waves. Square waves with harmonics gives us an unstable oscillator. I hope he's aware of that. Interesting. I'd like to see if he's going to email me the rest of this experiment, because I'd really like to know what the third one is for, unless that's for a correction factor for the oscillator, which might be. But all three of them, no, two of them move, one is stationary. The one on the right is stationary, the two on the left can approach in all directions.
It is a lot of art and science that goes into a good, clean oscillator. The experiment that I had where I was making this very sensitive, capacitive-sensing network, I made a network a couple of years ago that could easily measure in a quantitative manner, 10 to the minus 5 picofarads. Can you imagine? In other words, 10 micro picofarads. No. Yes. 10 to the minus 5 picofarads is what I was measuring. And as I told you, a person walks into the room and you could measure the change in capacitance easily because he did that, even though you got these two probes in each part sitting on a wooden table, if you know what I mean. But what I'm getting at is I needed a very pure 1 megahertz sine wave oscillator. I wanted the oscillator to be very pure as a sine wave. I didn't want any clipping to it. Because every oscillator has greater than unity gain in the feedback in order to start the oscillation. But it must go to an amplitude where it goes into the amount of limiting equal to your feedback loop gain. Therefore, limiting really means clipping. Make an oscillator change gain as a function of amplitude without changing the wave shape of the beautiful sine wave you're trying to create. Very difficult. The way Mr. Hewlett and Packard solved that problem, the product that got them on the air, so to speak, was the Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator. And what they did is to set up a a tube-type oscillator. I think it was a 6-7 tube, but I'm not sure. A dual triode tube. But they built a feedback pass that made an oscillator, and it was a Wien bridge network that gave them the resonance, an RC network. So as you changed the capacitance, you had a very linear change in frequency, very predictable. But in order to limit the feedback, that limited the amplitude, they used a light bulb, and the light bulb was located in the cathode to ground. In other words, the bias network of the tube had a light bulb, a small, you and I would call it a night light, so to speak. A small light bulb went from cathode to ground of one of those tube amplifiers. As the signal got stronger, the amount of AC signal that got into that cathode that coupled into the light bulb made the light bulb get brighter. And the nice thing about an incandescent light bulb is that an incandescent light bulb changes its resistance by more than 10-to-1 ratio. Let me drop it. Net. You pick up a 100-watt light bulb, for instance, and assume now I'm rounding off the numbers. Assume that my AC voltage in the wall is not 120 volts, but it's 100 volts, and it's a 100-watt light bulb. Therefore, that bulb, by definition, is drawing 1 ampere. 1 ampere at 100 volts RMS is 100 watts. 100 watts are being put into my incandescent light bulb. Therefore, when the light bulb is hot, it is a 100-ohm resistor. That's why it's drawing exactly 1 ampere. However, you take that 100-watt light bulb when it's cold. When it's hot, by the way, you will measure 1 ampere flowing through it. Therefore, you'll have beautiful confirmation that it is a 100-ohm resistor load. But when it's cold, you put your ohmmeter across the 100-watt light bulb, you will measure 100 ohms. You'll measure less than 10 ohms. That means that at the instant you first turn on that light bulb, it is drawing more than a kilowatt, even though it's a 100-watt light bulb. So as you can see, an incandescent light bulb, the tungsten filament gets up to a nice high temperature of around 2,000 degrees, 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. As such, its resistance changes by huge numbers. Therefore, a light bulb in a feedback circuit changes in a very nice controlled manner. Because the light bulb is a pure linear resistor at each individual temperature, therefore, that Wien bridge oscillator, that model Lewis Packard, makes the cleanest looking sine wave you've ever seen, even though it is in a kind of limiting. But the limiting magnitude is a light bulb. It's not clipping. It's not voltage clipping where the plate voltage is hitting the maximum and minimum, if you know what I mean. Very crafty circuit. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, in fact, that's a very interesting experiment for some of these young novices. They'd like to graph out that light bulb, any light bulb, like you say, 100-watt bulb, and actually monitor the current as they apply voltage to it and graph that out and see how effective that could be. That's a great system. And I had one of those last year in here for repair, and it did have a bad light bulb in it. And it was a very sloppy oscillator until that bulb was reinserted. And it was pretty stable after that, so it worked very well.
One of the things you'll notice with that Hewlett-Packard Model 200 audio oscillator, and various versions of it, I think go as high as a megahertz and beyond, and down to something like 20 hertz. When you set the oscillator at this lowest frequency, 10 hertz to 20 hertz, whichever it is, and you go from the on to the off mode, you'll notice a very peculiar characteristic. If you plotted the output sine wave, you'll notice that for the first 3 or 4 seconds, the amplitude of the sine wave jumps up and down. In other words, when you're down to the lowest possible frequency, which is around 10 hertz, the rate at which the filament of that light bulb can cool off and heat up is getting very close to the frequency at which you're generating. Therefore, the light, at the peak of the sine wave, the filament is a little bit hotter than it is at the valley of the sine wave, if you know what I mean. If you now plotted temperature of the filament, therefore resistance of the filament, as a function of the 0 to 360 degrees of the sine wave, the phase of the sine wave, you see a slight variation. As such, the whole oscillator network takes a little bit longer to stabilize when you're at the lowest frequency. You'll see it jump around for a few seconds before it settles down. whereas when you set it at 1 KC, within a couple, it's got a beautiful sine wave of just the right amplitude coming out at 1 KC. And now that you understand the feedback control mechanism in amplitude created by that light bulb, you see why it works that way. I was building an oscillator where I tried to make a very pure sine wave. Let me drop. And I was trying to make a very soft diode clipper. In other words, I had a pair of back-to-back diodes with a certain bias voltage on them. And if I put a bias voltage of 5 volts on the two diodes in the back-to-back, I expected a 10-volt peak-to-peak sine wave to come out. And as the oscillator exceeded 10 volts peak-to-peak, you start getting some clipping action from the diodes that I had set up in there. Therefore, the tops of the sine wave got distorted a little bit, and it was no longer a pure sine wave, and it gave me some grief. And so by having the right amount of series resistance with the diodes, I could make the clipping a much softer action, and therefore I made a cleaner sine wave. But it never quite met my desired harmonic distortion, if you know what I mean. The light bulb would be the right way to do it. And so I should have just given up and put in a grain of wheat light bulb into my oscillator circuit and given up on doing it with diodes. I was looking at an oscillator circuit that was in the, let me drop, a beautiful book on operational amplifiers. It's called the Burr-Brown Third Generation Techniques for Operational Amplifiers. And Green is the name of the author. Very good book, oldie but goodie. And in there's some very nice oscillator circuits, square wave, sine wave, multiple sine waves with 60 degrees or 90 degrees of phase shift between the outputs and so on. There's some very fancy ways you can set up a operational amplifier to make a very clean oscillator. And I was copying one of those circuits, but the problem was the real limiting was taking place by soft diode action. And so the quality of the sine wave was extremely good, but not as good as I would like. And I now realize that I just simply put in a light bulb, I would have done it. There are ways that you can control the feedback by way of a field effect transistor. Change the bias on a field effect transistor. The amount of resistance between the drain changes a little bit like the filament of a light bulb, but not quite as linear. The light bulb is not the linear thing in the world. I should have just given up to put in a grain of wheat light bulb in my solid-state circuit. Everything in my circuit was solid-state, except for the feedback, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Very good, Dick. You know, and by the way, at 20 hertz and below, when you would turn that on, we used to call that the heartbeat. And you could actually see that, depending on what you wanted to look at, whether the oscilloscope could see it or with voltmeters. And that was very interesting. But eventually it would stabilize as soon as the bulb had a temperature where it didn't have a chance to cool off as rapidly. And you mentioned op-amps. I don't know if you remember when HP and Tech used to have plug-ins that were op-amps. A simple op-amp. The thing was the size of a box of cigars. Now you can buy a much more expensive op-amp in a tiny little package. Fascinating stuff.
You're absolutely right, John. The original operational amplifiers done with 6SN7 tubes, for instance, like you said, were about the size of a cigar box. That worked very well. And now you can buy an integrated circuit package of, I'm going to make a guess, 1/8 inch square, in that order, which could have 4 separate op-amps built in there, where each individual op-amp has enough transistors in each individual op-amp so that they've got 100 or 110 decibels of gain. We've come a long way. And you might find that in a bubble pack at Radio Shack for 98 cents. 4 separate op-amps in one package. We've come a long way. And so learning how to use operational amplifiers for frequency selective circuits, oscillators, filters, to use operational amplifiers in a feedback network so that you get
K2UPS.
Hey, John, Rich is going to join us, K2UPS, so that you can get